Okay. Good evening, and I want to thank Shari Shemayim for once again hosting. This is another in our legal ethics series put on by Yeshiva University, Torah Mitzion, Beit Midrash Zichro Nedov, which is my organization. Again, as I announced before, especially if you want credit, please make sure that you do sign in. Also, if you want notification about future legal ethics classes, I have a note on the top of the class materials, which some of you may be aware of what that's about, and some of you may be looking at that and wondering what Panama is, but what has to do with this session. So the answer is that my Beit Midrash is looking at possibly putting together a trip to Panama for February 2019, including medical ethics classes that will be accredited for doctors and legal ethics sessions that will be accredited for lawyers. So if you're interested, it will be a week in Panama. It will include hotels, it will include kosher food, and a chance to tour in the community. Email Mickey Ostro, whose email address is right there at the top, and he'll give you information. Yeah, Panama sounds fun. Toronto in February does not. Okay, this session is dedicated in honor of a gift for my Beit Midrash's dinner last June by Eli Dadush. And I also want to make sure to thank, I don't remember at this point who the first one was who suggested this topic, but I want to thank whoever it was who suggested this topic to me. Honestly, when it was first suggested, the idea of talking about dealing with self-represented litigants, I thought it sounded a little dull. And you talk about the issues of what you can take advantage of, can't take advantage of. And then I came to understand as I started to prepare it, that it's really an access to justice issue. And that frames the way we look at it both from a law society perspective and from a Jewish law perspective. And that's what informs the way that I'm going to be looking at it tonight. And it's really been a lot more interesting than I thought it was going to be. So I'm grateful. Also want to give credit to two parties, one who is present, one who is not present. I want to thank Jeffrey Silver, who is somewhere here. Was here, there he is, for furnishing me with many materials, articles, and his own writing on this topic. It was very helpful. And the other is Rabbi Yonah Reese of Chicago. He is the head of the CRC, Chicago's Beit Din. He was the head of the Rabbinical Council of America's Beit Din out of New York. And he has quite a few lectures on the topic of being a lawyer online, and some of them were very helpful in working on this. Let's frame the problem. The issue of dealing with self-represented litigants, it's been observed, saw this in quite a few articles, that there is an increasing percentage of litigants who are choosing to represent themselves rather than have professional representation. Does that fit your observation? Is that what you're seeing also?
Yes.
Some yeses. I imagine it happens more in certain fields than in other fields. People are more apt to... Sorry? Family law. Yeah, that would certainly be one. In certain areas, people are more apt to represent themselves. And the reasons for representing oneself vary. Sometimes it's expensive to get a lawyer. It's complex to find the right lawyer, as though it won't be complex to actually, you know, pursue the litigation. A lack of trust in lawyers at times. The general trend within society of wanting to be independent of professionals, I'll take care of it myself, or just people with personalities that prefer to go it alone, as just a function of who they are. They prefer to do it themselves. And on the face of it, and again, I'm, you know, those of you who have been here before know, I am not a lawyer. I am married to one. I read the law a lot, but I'm actually, I don't practice it, never went to law school. But on the face of it, as a non-lawyer, I would look at it and say, what's the challenge in dealing with a self-represented litigant? Just the opposite. If I'm a trained professional, I have an advantage. I'm going to do very well. But there are numerous problems which come up in the course of dealing with litigation when the other side does not have professional representation. What are some of the problems that come up? Sorry?
Sorry.
So I'm going to skip that one. He raised questions about the sanity of the person on the other side. It happens to be true that there are personality types which will say, which are more apt to want to represent themselves. This is true, and sometimes it's because they can't find a lawyer who agrees with them and who will do what they want the lawyer to do. But beyond that, veering away from the personal.
Complicates the process.
In what way?
They're not familiar with procedures. They don't know what they're doing. They don't comply with deadlines.
They miss evidence that would help them, and they miss legal arguments that would help them.
They miss evidence and arguments that would help them. And how does that turn around to hurt you? How does that affect you as the lawyer on the other side? Because it does.
The judge.
The judge may jump in on their side. That's one problem. Yes. They might try to introduce inadmissible evidence. This is a concern as well, but there's more to it. Let's go through it a little systematically. Sorry? Appeal?
What the self-judge would say, you didn't have their problems, you didn't know what the law was. You should have another kick in the can.
Correct. They may be able to get an appeal because something wasn't heard, because the judge feels that the case was not decided on its merits in the end. Correct. Yes. There's an ethical issue as well. If you end up succeeding because of their ignorance, that's correct as well. Take a look at your sheets, please. I tried to bring you a set of citations from the Rules of Professional Conduct that touch on the various problems that are experienced. The first problem is just that the fact that you have an advantage threatens the access to justice of people who represent themselves. One of the things that I learned in the course of this is that the judicial system in Canada does not look at self-representation as inappropriate or aberrant or bad. It sees it as a normal state. There's nothing wrong with choosing to represent yourself. And as a result of that, you don't want the person who chooses to represent herself to suffer for it. So the professional representative on the other side is obligated to take steps to avoid taking advantage of the other. It's the same concern you have when dealing with a case in which everybody has professional representation and there's a concern for sharp practice. Concern that you not take advantage of mistakes on the other side that don't go to the merits of the case. But it's much bigger when you're dealing with someone who doesn't know what they're talking about. If you take a look at source number one from the Rules of Professional Conduct, these are rules that deal with the sharp practice issue, not the issue of a self-represented litigant on the other side. A lawyer shall be courteous, civil, and act in good faith with all persons with whom the lawyer has dealings in the course of their practice. A lawyer shall agree to reasonable requests concerning trial dates, adjournments, waiver, procedural formalities, similar matters that don't prejudice the rights of the client. A lawyer shall avoid sharp practice, shall not take advantage of or act without fair warning upon slips, irregularities, mistakes on the part of other legal practitioners, not going to the merits or involving the sacrifice of a client's rights. So normally, we say that you're responsible not to take advantage of mistakes and to ensure that the case will not be decided based on technicalities. This becomes an even bigger issue when you're dealing with somebody who's apt to make exactly those mistakes. We're going to come back to that theme later. That's one issue. A second issue, and this maybe goes back to where Zevi was going before about the personalities that can be involved in such a case, is the requirement of candor and courtesy. If you take a look at source number two and source number three from the Rules of Professional Conduct, when acting as an advocate, a lawyer shall not, and this is part of a list of shall nots, shall not knowingly attempt to deceive a tribunal or influence the course of justice by offering false evidence, misstating facts or law, presenting or relying upon a false or deceptive affidavit, suppressing what ought to be disclosed, or otherwise assisting in any fraud, crime, or illegal conduct, knowingly misstate the contents of a document, the testimony of a witness, the substance of an argument, or the provisions of a statute or like authority, shall not knowingly assert as true a fact when its truth cannot reasonably be supported by the evidence as a matter of which notice may be taken by the tribunal. You have to make sure that they that everything you do is above board and is correct. And then, in number three, a lawyer shall not, in the course of professional practice, send correspondence or otherwise communicate to a client, another legal practitioner, or any other person in a manner that is abusive, offensive, or otherwise inconsistent with the proper tone of a professional communication from a lawyer. We talked about this last year when we talked about issues of censure for personal misconduct and some of the things that lawyers have done that have gotten them into trouble. But when you're dealing with a self-rep who doesn't play by the same rules and who doesn't necessarily have the same standards in terms of their own conduct, you run into the possibility that they get you to do something that you know you shouldn't do, but ends up getting you into trouble. And that's a second element. Third problem that you can run into is suffering for the mistakes that are made by the self-represented party. If you take a look at the rules of civil procedure in number 4, the court may, only where and as necessary in the interest of justice, dispense with compliance with any rule at any time. Meaning that if the judge decides that the fact that the self-represented, litigant, missed a deadline, filed something incorrectly, or otherwise made a mistake that doesn't go to the merits of the case, the judge can decide to allow an appeal on that basis. The judge can decide to extend a deadline. The judge can decide to give them all sorts of breaks along the way, and you're out of luck. And therefore, not only are you out of luck, but your client is out of luck. And the result is that litigation can drag on. And if you take a look at number 5, you find an example of this from Moore v. Apollo. A case in which the court will dispense with compliance to rules and enable an appeal. In the present case, the trial judge did several things to discharge his responsibility to protect the right of the self-represented person to be heard. This is dealing with a case in which somebody had been hired, a woman had been hired to do work for a company, and she, in the end, ended up leaving the company. And in the course of litigation about the way that she was dismissed, the judge believed that she had given up on her claim for unpaid wages. And the appeal argues, no, she never gave up on that claim. And here you find in paragraph 47, however, the trial judge did not make sufficient inquiries before concluding Ms. Moore had abandoned her claim for unpaid wages. Where the evidence of a self-represented party raises a question in the trial judge's mind about the specific relief the party is seeking, a trial judge must make the appropriate inquiries of the party to clarify the matter. Those inquiries must be made in a clear, unambiguous, and comprehensive way so that several results occur. 1, the trial judge is left in no doubt about the party's position. 2, the self-represented person clearly understands the legal implications of the critical choice she faces about whether to pursue or abandon a claim. And 3, the self-represented person clearly understands from the trial judge which of her claims he will adjudicate. And it goes on to say the trial judge did not, in fact, do that, and the result was an unfair trial. If you look at those 3 items that are expected here, from paragraph 47, the trial judge has to be left in no doubt about the party's position. The self-represented person has to clearly understand the legal implications of the critical choice she faces. So the judge is going to need to make sure that the litigant understands not only what they are supposed to do, but what the implications are of their course of action one way or the other. The judge is going to go very far in order to help them. You, as the attorney, as the lawyer on the other side, can get yourself, either you can get yourself into trouble by not making sure that's clear, and then you end up facing an appeal later on. You could be told, well, you know, you're going to have to rehear this, or it's going to be extended. The client is going to end up having to pay more money in order to go through all of this. And that's another problem. One more problem. The problem of misunderstandings by this self-represented party on the other side. This happens so easily. You are a very nice lawyer, and you say, I am going to help them. I'm going to explain the deadline issue to them. I'm going to explain what they need to do. I'm even going to explain the import of their words. As a result, the self-represented party starts to think, I guess this is the way it works. I show up in court, here is my case, and this lawyer who's been hired by the other party is going to make sure I don't do anything foolish and everybody's nice and kumbaya, we're all friends. And the result of that is, that you end up in trouble because they thought you were giving them legal advice. Take a look. Flip the page to number 6, please. From the rules of professional conduct as well. When the lawyer deals on a client's behalf with an unrepresented person, the lawyer shall B, take care to see that the unrepresented person is not proceeding under the impression that their interests will be protected by the lawyer. Make sure that they don't think you're working for them. And C, take care to see that the unrepresented person understands that the lawyer is acting exclusively in the interest of the client, and accordingly their comments may be partisan. What I'm saying may be biased towards my client who is, you know, paying me to represent them. Now, what's really interesting to me about this, about number 6, and maybe somebody here can enlighten me, this is one of the rules of professional conduct that was changed when they made the 2014 edition. When I didn't include A in number 6, it's because A is blank. A was left out. What A said in the previous edition of the Rules of Professional Conduct was that the lawyer shall urge him to get representation. Urge the unrepresented party to pursue professional representation. And what I don't know is why that was taken out in the 2014 edition. So Jeffrey suggested, I emailed him to ask why this is taken out. He suggested it may just be unrealistic to really think that they're going to get representation. Realistically, the caseload is such that they're not necessarily going to find proper representation. Maybe. What do you think? Why do you think they took out the urge the other side to get a professional representative? So I was wondering about that. Reed suggests that maybe it's because it looks like legal advice. When you say to them, get representation, maybe it appears... Thank you very much. Okay, that's perfect. Maybe it looks like you're actually giving them professional counsel? Could be. Perfect. Right, Zerving points out it's the responsibility perhaps of the judiciary to make that recommendation, and in fact, that is true, meaning that the guidance that's given to judges is that they are supposed to make that recommendation. So you think because it becomes the judge's responsibility, it's taken off of the lawyer's plate. Maybe. That could be also a possibility. Okay. I couldn't find any literature on it online from when they made the decision to remove it. Yeah. And it's absolutely a constitutional right for them to represent themselves.
If you are giving them legal advice, not to exercise the constitutional
right. We do that all the time, right? To tell somebody not to necessarily exercise every right they have. Now, the question is whether it's good to give it as legal advice is another story. Because what happens if you told them to get professional representation and it doesn't work out? Right? Are you then on the hook because you gave them the advice to go get counsel? Yeah, that may well be.
That phrase usually comes up after somebody asks you for advice. Very often, self-representative litigants will come up to you and say, what do you think? Should I? I say, well, I think you've got to do this, but you know what? I represent my client. I can't even give you legal advice. I suggest you get legal advice.
Right.
I mean, it's a constitutional right if you know what you're doing, but if you don't know what you're doing, you're harming yourself.
We have all sorts of constitutional rights. We have the right to lose a case also. Jerry.
So you're titling this facing self-represented litigants.
Yes.
Are you limiting it to that? Because this particular section is one that applies in commercial situations too.
Right. So it is broader than litigants, and in fact we're about to see, or I'm going to refer to something called the Statement of Principles on Self-Represented Litigants and Accused Persons. Comes up in criminal law also.
Even commercial.
Yeah, absolutely true. Right. Right, and that's your constitutional right. Right. So for anyone who couldn't hear on the far side of the room, the air conditioner in this room is very loud. But what Joey said is that, you know, you could have somebody on a mortgage who says they want to represent themselves. It might be wise to say, I don't want to deal with you. because of all the problems that can arise if you have somebody who doesn't know the ins and outs. You can get into trouble later. So what you have is the Canadian Judicial Council drafts a document called the Statement of Principles on Self-Represented Litigants and Accused Persons in 2006. And it's supposed to give guidance not only for lawyers, but for the court, in dealing with self-represented parties. And if you take a look at 7, a case from the Supreme Court of Canada from just last year, where they stated, we would add that we endorse the Statement of Principles on Self-Represented Litigants and Accused Persons established by the Canadian Judicial Council. That becomes accepted as protocol. And we're going to talk about what it actually says in a little bit. So I gave you the following cases in number 8. With all of this as background, number 8, I gave you 4 cases. And I'm just going to very quickly go through them, but we'll tackle them one by one when we're ready for it. First case, Jonathan sued XLF Pharmaceuticals and lost. He is representing himself in an appeal. Mary, lead counsel for XLF, sees that Jonathan is having difficulty meeting the filing deadline for his factum, but he doesn't seem to be aware that he can request an extension. Is Mary expected to inform Jonathan of this option? That's question number 1. Number 2, still with a self-represented litigant. After a car accident, Sarah can no longer work. She files an insurance claim without legal representation. The insurer cites Section 33 of the statutory accident benefit schedule and requests that she sign OCF-5 permitting disclosure of her medical records. David, counsel for the insurance company, knows that Sarah could legitimately limit their access to 1 year prior to the accident. Is David required to advise Sarah of this limiting option? That's your second. Third, a wildfire spreads through a neighborhood, destroying Rhonda's house. Rhonda's insurer pays living expenses for 6 months, but refuses to pay for the insured home itself. This came from an actual case. If anyone is familiar with the case this came from. Veronica, counsel for the insurer, can see that Rhonda's lawyer is providing inadequate representation, and the likely result will be protracted litigation or a settlement for far less than Rhonda deserves. Does Veronica have any obligation to Rhonda, whose lawyer is not doing a good job? And then last, Mary, lead counsel for XLF Pharmaceuticals in back in our first case, advises Jonathan regarding his extension. Jonathan is grateful, as he is on the next 3 occasions, when Mary provides guidance on procedural issues. Are there any concerns Mary should keep in mind while advising Jonathan? You already know because we already led into it, but we'll come back to it. Those are the 4 cases that I'd like to address. In order to get to these cases, we have to start by looking at the principle of access to justice in Jewish law as well as in general law in Canada. So, from a Canadian perspective, there is a general duty of the community to provide access to justice for everyone, including self-represented parties. The goal is to enable society to function in a way that is fair. So I brought you a quote, which I like to bring on the topic, from Chief Justice Nemitz, 1985. We have no doubt that the right to access to the courts is, under the rule of law, one of the fundamental pillars protecting the rights and freedoms of our citizens. There are plenty of other articles I could quote and quotations I could bring, but that's the basic point. Yes, Moshe. I'm going to come back to 3. I don't want to deal with the vignettes yet. I just mentioned them. You'll see when we come back to it. You're right, but you'll see. Okay. But that's in terms of the general point within society of providing access to justice. Within Judaism, you find an imperative as well of providing access to justice operating on several planes. First of all, perhaps most famously, the verse in Devarim and Deuteronomy, source number 10. I brought the Hebrew for the sources because I think it's important to have the authentic original, but in the interest of time, I'm only going to read out the English. You shall place judges and officers at all of your gates, which Hashem, your God, gives you for your tribes, and they shall judge the nation righteously. The imperative of setting up courts does not just mean make sure that there is such a thing as a court. It also means make sure that you establish courts that are convenient for people. So take a look at the passage from the Talmud in source number 11, which states that they established courts that would judge on Mondays and Thursdays. Why Mondays and Thursdays? Because people are available as they come read from the Torah. There's a communal Torah reading publicly on Monday and Thursday morning. And therefore, it's more likely that people who live in outlying areas will make it into town to go to the synagogue on Monday and Thursday morning. And therefore, they will also be able to have their cases heard. Those were also market days, increasing the traffic as well. Some debate as to which came first, the judging or the market day. But that's one example of this emphasis on making sure that people will have access to the courts. Another example is source number 12. There's a biblical verse that says, "You shall hear the small like the great." Kakaton kagadol tishmaun. Reish Lakish, one of the sages of the Talmud, lives roughly 4th century, maybe 5th, said, "The law of a pruta is the most minimal coin in the Talmud, should be as beloved to you as the law of 100 maneh," something that is many multiples of the single pruta. For what? What does that mean? I have to be honest, of course, in every case, no matter the quantity that's under discussion. So what are you emphasizing when you say that I should value all of these cases? If to examine and rule properly, that's obvious. Of course I have to be careful about all cases. Rather, the point is to put it first. Meaning, the rule is first come, first serve. Case comes before you that's a small, they didn't have the division of small claims court and other matters. So if a case comes to you, and it's a $10 case, and then there's a $1 million case that's waiting, too bad. First I'm going to take care of the $10 case, and then I'll get around to the $1 million case. You take the cases in the order in which they come in. You want to make sure that there will be access to justice for everybody. Clear? Another example of this. Take a look at source number 13. There's a biblical text which states, "There shall be one law for all of you." Mishpat echad yelachem. There is one law for everybody. The rabbis of the Talmud explain that to mean that we have the same rules, the same standards, whether we're dealing with a financial case or a capital case where life and death are in the balance. Biblically, the same care has to be taken. Now, they actually walked that back and said, but in practice we don't do it, because they had a problem. There was a concern that if you're going to apply severe standards of interrogation of witnesses for financial cases, the result is going to be no one's going to want to lend anybody money. Because they're going to say, if in order for me to prove that my loan was actually extended to this person, I'm going to have to drag in witnesses and they're going to have to go through a crazy cross-examination, I may actually lose my loan. Forget it. Why should I get involved at all in lending money? And remember that lending money, biblically, is viewed as a form of tzedakah, as a form of charity. So in order to ensure that loans will continue, they said, we're going to loosen things up. But from a biblical perspective, we want the same rigor applied to all types of cases. And then one more rule that supports this idea, and it's a rule that I think is also critical. It's in source number 14. And this is one we're going to have to come back to. We're going to have to expand on this. Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. Do not act like Orchei Hadayanim, which it may be best translated as arrangers of the judges. What does that mean to be an arranger of the judge? You know, of course, that in modern Hebrew, the word for lawyer is Orech Din. Arranger of the judgment. But what does it mean to be an arranger of the judge? So commenting there, Rashi, in his classic commentary, offers a few explanations, but here's one of them. If a person comes to you for advice as to how he could sue another, do not give him any advice to teach him how to sue another. He doesn't want you to help one side over the other. Everything should be even-handed. That's why he looks at it. Now again, we have to come back to this, because this is not so clear cut. But what emerges is a sense that in Jewish law, as in secular law, there's a drive to make sure that everyone has access to the court system, and that everyone has equal access to the courts. In particular, officers of the court are required to provide access to justice for the vulnerable. That comes to the judge, and it comes to the lawyer. First, we'll look at it in the Canadian system. There is a duty of the judge as an officer of the court to make sure that the litigant is able to make the points that the litigant wants to make. Take a look at number 15, a quote from that statement of principles. Judges have a responsibility to inquire whether self-represented persons are aware of their procedural options and to direct them to available information if they are not. Depending on the circumstances and nature of the case, judges may explain the relevant law in the case and its implications before the self-represented person makes critical choices. So the judge is going to intervene and say, this is what I think you ought to consider as you make your decision. Here are the things that you ought to know about the implication of what you're about to do. And that goes back to the case with Moore that we saw, right? When we saw the paragraphs in source number 5 from Moore v. Apollo, we said there, the judge makes the argument that the original judge who heard the case did not advise Moore of the implications of her actions. Now that's the judge. Does a lawyer have this level of responsibility to the other side to make sure they're aware of the implications of their actions? Sergio says no. I have a no here also. Anyone think that lawyers have this responsibility to the other side? It would be a conflict. It would exactly be a conflict. So take a look at source 16 from Thomas Heinzman. He writes, this is in notes of his called Ethical Issues Relating to Lawyers and Unrepresented Litigants in the Civil Justice System. He's a shorter title. Presently, he says, I have been a chair of a committee of the American College of Trial Lawyers, which has drafted a code of conduct for trial lawyers in trials involving unrepresented litigants. He says, apart from the duty to the court and his professional regulating body, the lawyer's only duty is to the client, his own paying client. The lawyer is prohibited from creating any conflict of interest between that duty and a duty to others. You can't say, you can't tell me that the lawyer who is working for one side is going to be required to take care of and inform the other side. Be candid? You bet. Be civil? You bet. Allow for procedural elements to be adjusted to help the self-represented party? You bet. Tell him, what's going to happen if he does this? That's not my job. And it's not in the statement of principles either. Yeah. But it doesn't obligate the lawyer for the other side to inform them of their...
No, but if your counsel for the Crown...
Right, the Crown case you're making two points, right? One is the Crown attorney case, and the other is the issue of the disabled.
Right.
Right. So in terms of the disabled, it doesn't obligate the lawyer for the other side to do that. Sorry?
The Crown doesn't do that.
Right. The Crown will send you to duty counsel who will inform you of, you know, of rights and so on. But not, it's not that, but it's not that they're...
The other thing is that there's also obligation to the person, you know, the individual that's disabled under the Ontario...
Right, again, this is... Right, right. A right to be represented isn't the question. The question is whether the lawyer who's representing the other side is going to be obligated to explain to this party what the implications of their actions are. And that's, I think, where we draw the line and say that the lawyer of the other side isn't going to have to. If you want, I can pursue it after, but I'm gonna continue with it here. Moshe, and then we're going
to
go on.
Back to three.
Yeah.
The case in three—that's what actually.
Okay, I'm really not going back to three yet.
No, it's just that this is what we just discussed now goes back to three, because in some situations, the counsel for the like the words weren't exactly words. Like to result from tactical litigation, those words basically says protect his own client by explaining the other individual that he hasn't let cost his client.
Yeah, hang in there. Hang in there. We're getting there. Okay. So what we've established is, number one, society as a whole has a responsibility to make sure that people have access to justice and equal access to justice. Number two, that officers of the court have to provide access to justice for the vulnerable, but the burden really is on the judge rather than on the lawyer when it comes to going far enough to actually explain things to the unrepresented party. Within the Jewish system, it really sits on the judge. And the reason simply is because the lawyer position is not natural to a Beit Din, to a rabbinical court, as we're going to talk, but as we're going to see in our sources here. But take a look at source number 17, because I found this to be a very helpful source. Rabbeinu Husher, also known as the Rush, writing, as you see, a good 700 years ago, says the following. If one party comes to court and says, I have a claim against Plony. Plony is John Doe, so-and-so. I have a claim against Plony, and I have discovered assets of his in a certain place, and I fear that if they reach him, he will hide them, and I will have no means of collecting my debt. There is property of his that I could claim, but once he gets a hold of it, it's going to be gone. And he requests that the court hold the property until his claim is clarified. If the judge sees logic in the claim, or that Reuven would not be able to collect his debt from Shimon, we've now taken away the Plony. We now know their names. Reuven would not be able to collect his debt from Shimon when the time came, then the judge is instructed to hold the property of the defendant until the plaintiff clarifies his claim. And he says, so I have found from the Gaon Zal, it's unclear to me who he's quoting when he says the Gaon, but it doesn't matter for our purposes. He says, I have found that there is a rabbinic enactment regarding a defendant who destroys his property to restore loss. He is responsible still to pay for whatever debt he incurred, to pay for whatever obligation he has. It appears to me, though, that there is no need for rabbinic enactment. You don't need an enactment to say defendants shouldn't be able to abscond with their property to avoid paying their debts. It is straightforward law that one is obligated to save the abused party from one who would abuse him with any available strategy. He's addressing the judge, and what he's saying is that the goal of litigation in a Beit Din, in a rabbinical court, is, the words in the Hebrew are, Latzil Ashuk Miyad Oshko, which I translated in the English, to save the abused party from one who would abuse him. That's what you're supposed to be doing in court. And therefore, if the judge senses that one party is able to take advantage of the other, the judge is not only licensed, but as Rabbeinu Asher says, the judge is obligated to act in a way that will prevent one side from taking advantage of the other. But it gets even stronger. Source number 19. Actually, number 18 first, sorry. Number 18 is Maimonides bringing the same concept. Maimonides points to a biblical passage that describes the types of judges who we are supposed to appoint. One of the terms used biblically is that we are looking for anshei chayil, Men of Chayil. The word Chayil is a vague word in Hebrew. It can mean many different things. It can mean wealth. It can mean courage. It can mean strength. When you think of all the different translations for Eshet Chayil, status also, correct? Right? But when we translate Eshet Chayil, it is a women of valor. That may be a translation. There are a lot of different ways to take it. But he says here, what does it mean when you're looking for judges who are men of Chayil? They must have a brave heart to save the abused from one who would abuse him. The same phrase. As it says, and Moshe arose and saved them. When Moses fled from Egypt and he ran to Midian, he saw women who were being attacked or being harassed at the well, and he jumped up and saved them from those who were harassing them. That's what we want the judge to do. That's the job of the judge. Joey? Oh, absolutely it can lead to judicial abuse. Not it could, it will. We're getting there. You are 100% right. Hang in there. Rambam is going to make the point soon. Yes?
I'm not a litigator, but I've never seen in the law on Mareva injunctions that anybody's ever quoted Rabbeinu Usher.
Well, that is something that needs to be remedied. It's a good thing you're all here, because you can bring it up. That is absolutely true. That's why I made it very clear, or I thought I made it very clear, that I'm presenting both the legal side of it and the Jewish law side of it. For the sake of clarity, the Law Society, when they approved the CPB, knew it as well. So we're good. They evidently reviewed it. Or they knew it in advance, for all I know. Sorry. Okay.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
If they feel that one side's not going to pay, or one side doesn't have a proper argument, or they live out of town.
Oh, absolutely.
For an amount of money.
Yeah, yeah.
They have to lay in the court.
No, that's true. So that's one principle within Judaism. The idea that the goal of litigation is to save the abused party from the abuser. Take a look, though. It goes even further. Take a look at number 19. A passage from Mishlei, from Proverbs. Actually, right before the Eshet Chayil that I just referenced. Open your mouth for the mute. This is advice that Bathsheba, Bathsheba gave to her son, Shlomo, King Solomon. This is her advice to him. She says, open your mouth for the mute, for the judgment of all whose aid is transient. In other words, if people don't have help, you have to be the one who will help them. Open your mouth. Judge righteously, litigate for the poor and indigent. That's the principle known in Hebrew as Psach Picha Le'ilein. Open up your mouth for those who cannot speak. And it's a basic tenet, again, of the way that we approach Jewish law. So take a look at source number 20, a case out of the Talmud, when two litigants came to Rav. Rav is a sage in the 3rd century. This requires a little bit of introduction. There is a rule in Jewish law. Every 7 years, when you get to the sabbatical year, loans that are overdue for payment are nullified. Loans that are overdue are simply canceled. It's the law of Shemitah. However, the Torah also warns that in the event that the Shemitah year is coming, the sabbatical year is coming, you shouldn't say, I'm not going to lend people money because I know what's going to happen. They won't pay me on time and then the loan will be nullified. Don't abstain from lending. You have to continue to lend. And the sages saw that that wasn't happening. People were violating that left and right. And so they found there's an existing loophole within the law which states that if a loan is turned over to a rabbinical court for collection, it's not nullified by the sabbatical year. And so they created a document called a prosbul. And that document essentially says, I hereby assign all of my loans to the rabbinical court for collection. Even though the rabbinical court is never going to see them, I have no intention of turning over them, and they're not going to collect it. Nonetheless, this would encourage people once again to lend and to fulfill their biblical obligation to aid others with loans. So this is a key document, this prosbul document. So now, two people come to Rav with a case. Person X says, I lent money to person Y before the Shemitah year, before the sabbatical year. Person Y says, but it's too bad. The year has already passed. The loan is now void. So look what Rav used to do in number 20. When they came to Rav, he would ask, perhaps you had a prosbul and it was lost. Could it be that you had such a document and it's just not with you anymore? And the Talmud says this is an example of opening your mouth for the mute. You're making the claim that he could have made. Source 21, similarly, a passage from the Jerusalem Talmud, the Hebrew's on the bottom of one side, the English on the top of the next side. When Rav Huna knew merit for a litigant, and the litigant did not know, he would start for him. He would open it up for him. Quoting this verse, open your mouth for the mute. He would make the argument on behalf of the litigant. And that brings me to a remarkable story in source number 22. Also requires a little bit of explanation. It involves options, but I'm going to see if I can explain it without resorting to anything terribly complex. We know that when a couple gets married in Jewish law, there's something called a ketubah. The ketubah is essentially a prenuptial agreement that documents the husband's obligations to the wife. And one of the elements that's found in the ketubah is that in the event of his death or in the event of divorce, he or his estate will pay her a certain sum of money. So she has this sum of money, the ketubah money, waiting for her in the event that he predeceases her, or in the event that the marriage ends in divorce. However, there were times when, still maybe times when, the woman wants money now. And so she says, I'm going to sell off the right to my ketubah. I'm selling an option on my ketubah. Let's say the ketubah was worth, I'm making up numbers, let's say the ketubah was worth $50,000. So I will sell it, I'll sell the right to collect $50,000 to somebody. Maybe they'll only pay me $10,000 or $20,000, whatever it is, because they know it's possible that the wife will die first. In which case, the ketubah money is never going to get collected. So she says, I'll sell it to somebody now, and then in the event that it comes due, they'll get the $50,000. Are we clear? That's what we're talking about. So the following story happened. Take a look at source number 22. Rav Nachman, a sage from the times of the Talmud, his relative sold an option on her ketubah claim that somebody else could actually claim the ketubah. She was divorced, so the money was coming to her, and therefore to the other guy. But before the money could be claimed, she passed away. So the people who had bought the right to her ketubah, they came to claim the ketubah from her daughter. She has the estate. She has the money. We want the money from this kid. Rav Nachman said to the sages, will no one counsel her? There's great advice for her. What she should do is do the following. She stands in place of her mother. So let her forgive her mother's claim on her father for the ketubah. So forgive the ketubah obligation from the father. The father then does not pay it to the people who bought the ketubah. And then when the father dies, one day, this daughter will inherit the money. You follow? You follow what's going on? He's giving advice for her to circumvent the right of the person who bought the rights to the ketubah. She has the power, standing in place of her mother, to forgive the right to the ketubah that her mother had, and then she'll end up inheriting it. So she heard this, and she went and forgave it. She followed the advice. Rav Nachman then said, I shouldn't have done that. We have made ourselves as those who arrange the judges. We warned in source number 14, you're not supposed to try to fix a case. So I really shouldn't have done it. So the Talmud asks, then why did he do it? If he shouldn't do it, what made him do it in the first place? And the answer is because we have a verse in the prophet Yeshaya in Isaiah. He says, "Mibisarchalo tit alein." You shouldn't ignore your own flesh. You have a relative. You have an obligation to your relative. So he thought, I should really help her out. But then he thought, yeah, but I'm a person of standing within the community. I'm a person of stature within the community. It's not right for me to do something like this that people could learn to do inappropriate things because they'll do it in a case when it's not a relative as well. So commenting on that story, take a look at source number 23. Rabbi Yom Tov Elasvili, writing in Spain, looks at this story and he says, without a doubt, this daughter was poor. Has to be. And since the purchasers had only bought it at an option price, he gave this advice so she would pay the purchasers that which they had given her mother and they would lose none of their investment. The point was not to cheat the people who bought the ketubah. They paid, let's say, $10,000 for it. She's going to pay them the $10,000 that she cost them. But that way she'll get the $50,000 in the end. Otherwise, it would be very shocking for Rav Nachman to give advice to cause the purchasers, who acted legally, to lose for the sake of satisfying the need to help his relative. My point in bringing this case is to show an example of giving advice to help somebody who otherwise wouldn't know what their rights are. In the same way that Rav says, I want to help the litigant, and I'm going to say, maybe you had a principal document, and Rav Huna says, if I know a way to help the litigant, I'm going to say it. Here, in this example, Rav Nachman offers that kind of assistance towards his relative. Looking at the time, I think I'm going to cut a little bit short the next couple of sources, which is too bad because it's a great case, 24 and 25. Maybe if there's time at the end, I'll come back to it, but I think it can be skipped for now. But this informs practical procedure in a rabbinical court. Take a look at source number 26, which is where we come back to Joey's concern. 26 is Maimonides' advice on how you handle a case. How do we know that a judge should not act as an interpreter for the litigant's words? The Torah says, distance yourself from falsehood. Don't try to say what the litigant did not say. Don't make the case that the litigant did not make. Rather, he should say what appears to him and be silent. And he, the judge, should not teach either litigant any claim. Even if a litigant brings just one witness, he shouldn't say, we don't accept one witness. Right? We know the rule in the Torah is, rabbinical court needs two witnesses. What if one side brings one witness? He says, the judge shouldn't reject it. The judge should not act on behalf of the other litigant and provide the rejection of the single witness. Rather, he should say to the defendant, this one has testified against you. If only the other one would admit and say he testifies honestly, maybe it'll work. Until the defendant says he's just one witness and he's not credible to me. And so in all similar cases. He says, you don't make the case on behalf of the party. But if the judge sees merit for one of them, one party, and that litigant tries to make the point, but does not know how to put it together, or the judge sees that the litigant is taking pains to save himself with an honest point, but it escapes him because of his rage and anger, or he's confused because of his foolishness, then he may assist the litigant a little to explain the beginning of it under open your mouth for the mute. He says, if you see that he's trying to do something, and he's just not succeeding in getting the words out, he doesn't know how to formulate it, then the judge does step in, but then Maimonides concludes, one must be very careful with this, lest he be as those who arrange the judges, because this enables a judge, fundamentally, to be the ultimate activist, and to say, I am going to essentially litigate on behalf of the other side. So, what emerges here is that the secular system, which operates here in Canada, says we want the judge to try to make sure that the litigant understands the implications of the litigant's actions. The lawyer only has to make sure, the lawyer on the other side only has to make sure to be accommodating, to be courteous, not to take advantage of mistakes, but that's really the limit of what we expect of the lawyer. Within the Jewish system, we aren't turning to the lawyer for anything, because once again, the lawyer isn't there in the original Jewish system. It's the judge who's looked upon, but the judge is given quite a bit of leeway to alter the way the case goes and to make suggestions that the judge thinks the litigant really wanted to make and just didn't know how to frame. But I'll go one step further with a modern writer, Rabbi Moshe Sternbach. He's a judge now in Israel. He was in South Africa. He was born in England. In source number 27, he deals with something called a Toein Rabbani. Anyone know what a Toein Rabbani is? It's a rabbinic advocate. Literally, it's a rabbinic advocate. And what it is a position in a Beit Din, in a rabbinical court. It is quite common in many rabbinical courts to have the sides bring somebody who will make the case on their behalf. It is a very controversial practice for a number of reasons. Rabbi Reese, in his lectures on the topic, points out one major problem is that there's no bar association for these rabbinic advocates. which means it's the Wild West. They can say whatever they want and do whatever they want, and they're not going to be sanctioned by any professional body. Sorry? Basin here doesn't allow it. Yeah, it's a very controversial practice, the towing issue. But my point is not that. My point is to show you what Rabbi Sternbach has to say about it in number 27. He is worried about the case in which one side has the toein and the other side does not. Or one side has a really good toein and the other side does not. And he says it appears that if one side has an excellent and expensive toein rabbani, rabbinic advocate, and the other lacks any similar means, there is concern this might block his claims. Like the Talmud says, how do we know that if two parties come to court, one wearing rags and the other wearing a 100 mana shirt, a very expensive shirt, we tell him, you wear like the other guy's wearing, or dress him like you're dressed? Because the Torah says, distance yourself from falsehood. Make sure you're not going to be biased. So there is an imperative Talmudically to make sure that both litigants are dressed in the same way. So he says, well, how does that play out if one side has the high-powered lawyer and the other one does not? Certainly in our case it would be appropriate to say to someone who has an excellent, expensive lawyer, give the other one what you have or present as he does. Now, it will not shock you to find out that's not the way the world works. This doesn't actually happen. And so he writes, in truth, people do not do this because our adjudication is actually mediation in general. What happens in rabbinical court today is much more mediation than it is application of law. And the judges don't sense that this imbalance would block the other party's claims, and therefore they don't prevent it. But he's very unhappy with the idea because he would rather make sure that everybody has full representation. So what you have is between the two sides, the non-Jewish system and the Jewish system, a consistency more or less of saying that society has to provide equal access, the judge should provide equal access. There seems to be more of an activism on the part of the judges in a Beit Din, in a rabbinical court, than you will find in the secular system. But there's one other element here in which we say that Judaism expects more, and that is the element of chesed, the element of, what the hell, the element of kindness. Meaning, in secular law, we've discussed this on other occasions, the rule in Ontario is that there is no duty to rescue. I don't have, unless I have a special relationship with somebody, I don't have an obligation to go above and beyond and protect their interests. That's the rule in Ontario. Quebec is different. When it comes to Judaism, there is very much an obligation to rescue others. Whether it is, as I brought in number 28, the verse that says that if somebody loses his property, I am responsible to restore it for him, or potentially the rule of Lo Samal Al Dam Reyecha, don't stand by while somebody's blood is shed, which is a passage that many interpret to apply even to financial loss, I have a duty to help others. Now, for a lawyer, that will be offset by the fact that I also have a duty, a fiduciary duty to my client. But it's worth noting, in general, there is this added obligation. So far what we've done is we've spelled out the access to justice reasons for trying to help the self-represented party. However, there are limits in terms of how far we have to go because of certain principles. Number one, you have to be fair to the represented litigant. It's not fair to the fellow who paid for a lawyer if everybody's going to bend over backwards to help the guy on the other side. I gave you an example of this in source number 29, Cicciarella versus Cicciarella. I'm not going to quote it here. I gave you the whole transcript here that's brought from the appeal. But essentially what happens is the judge does everything possible to help this fellow, and when the other side tries to intercede, shuts them down and doesn't let them actually engage in the questioning and in the conversation at all. And that ends up being a problem. The judge has a duty not to overbalance in favor of the self-represented party. Within Judaism as well, there's a concern about not overbalancing, not going too far. Rashi, source number 30, comments on the story I mentioned before that involved the daughter who forgave her mother's right to the ketubah, and the concern of making ourselves like those who arrange the judges or arrange the judgment. He says, we have made ourselves like an arranger, like a relative or friend of the litigant coming to the judges and arranging with proofs for the merit of his friend or relative. Thus, I taught this counsel to cause the opposition to lose. That's his criticism. The criticism that Rav Nachman gave of himself is, I should not have gone this far getting involved in a fight that's not my own. So as a matter of basic fairness, we don't want you getting too far into helping the self-represented party. It's not fair. That's number one. Number two, you run into issues of appearances, because it can look like you are biased for the other side. I brought you the classic quote in number 31 from Lord Chief Justice Heward in England. Right? He's dealing with a case in which there was a motorcycle accident. Right? You're familiar with this? With the case? You're familiar with the quote. There was a motorcycle accident, and there was a civil action as a result of it, and then there was a criminal proceeding as well. And the clerk to the justices hearing the criminal proceeding happened to also be a member of the firm that was hearing the civil action against the motorcycle rider. So this clerk retires to the room with the justices who are discussing the criminal case, and the justices come out ruling against the defendant. The defendant appeals, and he says, wait a minute, he's on the case against me in civil court. That's his argument. And the justices swear an affidavit saying the clerk did not speak at all. When we were having our discussion, he was there because he's always there, but the clerk didn't say a word. And Lord Chief Justice Heward in number 31 says, it is said, and no doubt truly, that when that gentleman retired in the usual way with the justices, taking with him the notes of the evidence in case the justices might desire to consult him, the justices came to a conclusion without consulting him, and that he scrupulously abstained from referring to the case in any way. But while that is so, a long line of cases shows that it is not merely of some importance, but is of fundamental importance, that justice should not only be done, but should manifestly and undoubtedly be seen to be done. Right? That's the part that everybody knows. The end of the quote. It has to also be seen to be done. You can't have the appearance of impropriety. And we have the same concern in a Jewish law perspective. So that when the argument was made before, Rav Nachman said, I shouldn't have given her the advice, even though she's my relative. Why? A person of status in the community is different. Why is this person different? Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki Rashi in source number 32 explains, because people learn from what he does, and they will extrapolate inappropriate behavior as a result. That's number one. We're worried about people doing things that are improper as a result. But number two, take a look at source number 33 and the point that's made by Maimonides about how you have to make sure that you're not going to project a favoritism which leads one of the parties to say, forget it, the judge is against me. He says, there's a mitzvah for a judge to judge righteously. As it says, you shall judge your peer righteously. What is the righteousness of justice? What does that mean, judge righteously? This is equating the two litigants in all ways. Do not have one speak as much as he needs and tell the other, abbreviate your words. Do not show favor to one, speaking to him softly, and show a negative face to the other and speak to him harshly. And that's the way that we're supposed to run our cases. I brought it in 34 as well, but I'll skip it in the interests of time. We are taught to make sure not to discourage the represented litigant. So therefore, we now say there are two reasons why you should make sure not to overbalance for the self-represented party. Number one, fairness. And number two, appearance of fairness. And then, of course, there's the fact that you have a duty to the person who hired you. Right? This goes back to Heintzman's point that we made in the beginning. Right? Your duty is to your clients. So therefore, you're not, I brought it in number 35, you're all familiar with it for sure, from the Rules of Professional Conduct. specifically the commentary. In adversarial proceedings, the lawyer has a duty to the client to raise fearlessly every issue, advance every argument, ask every question, however distasteful, that the lawyer thinks will help the client's case. That's your job. So we can't tell you, and by the way, you have to also take care of the issues of the other side. It doesn't work that way, not in secular law, and it doesn't work that way in Jewish law as well, because you are not expected to give up your livelihood for the sake of the self-represented fellow on the other side. I brought you source number 36. I'm going to explain it outside of the text. Number 36 is a fascinating case. The question is this. I have an obligation of tzedakah. I have an obligation to help people in need. What if I own a grocery store? And a pauper walks into my grocery store and he says, "Would you give me some food on credit?" Am I obligated to do so as a function of tzedakah, as a form of philanthropy? Is that my obligation? What would you say? I've been monologuing for a long time. What would you say? Is the owner of a grocery store obligated? No. It's his parnasa. This is his livelihood. That's correct. This is his livelihood. The same thing is true when it comes to being the lawyer, and on the other side there's a self-represented party. He can't demand tzedakah from you. He can't demand that you harm your livelihood in order to ensure. Now, mind you, if the person walks into the grocery store starving, then, you know, it doesn't have any food and hasn't eaten today, then yes, you should still give it to him. But you're not supposed to go broke helping everybody who's going to come into your store and make demands. So what we're saying here is, again, very similar in the Jewish and secular systems in terms of the limitations of your obligations, except for one point. And this goes back to something I said at the outset. And once we address this, we'll be ready to address our cases. And that is that the secular system, the general system, says being self-represented is your right. You can do it. It's considered normal. And we will not have any prejudice against you. And just the opposite, everyone has to try to help you. Jewish law may not actually make that argument. Where there is an option, where everybody has equal access to representation, it's possible to argue that it's his own fault for not getting a representative. He had the option, and he chose not to do it. My basis for saying this is the case in source number 37, also dealing with a ketubah issue. The ketubah, one of the things that's stipulated in the document when a man and a woman get married is that a man is going to provide for his wife's food. All of her mizonot, all of her food. That can come in one of two forms. Either every day she goes out and gets whatever she wants and he has to bankroll it. Or, second way, he can say to her, "Listen, here's a piece of property. I'd like to assign that. And throughout our marriage, that's what you'll use. You want to sell it off, you want to rent it out, you want to do whatever you want. It comes from that property." And if she agrees, then that works. So look at this story, number 37. Rabbi Yochanan's relative had a stepmother who was consuming large amounts for her food. The relatives came to Rabbi Yochanan, who told them, "Go tell your father, designate a parcel of land for her food." So he gave that advice. Commenting on that, in source number 38, Tosfot, an anthology of commentaries, as you see, 12th to 14th century, they make the point that Rabbi Yochanan elsewhere gave advice and afterwards said, "I shouldn't have done that." But here, he didn't regret giving the advice. Why not? And the answer is, even though Rabbi Yochanan regretted giving advice elsewhere, here there was no disgrace, because accepting the land would depend upon her consent. In other words, there's nothing wrong with me giving that advice if they had the option of figuring out whether it was good advice or not. She, in other words, he says to the kid, "Go tell your father to assign her a parcel of land." The father says, "Okay, I'm going to do it." He goes to her and he says, "Use this parcel of land for your food." She has the option at that point to say yes or no. It's up to her. She can evaluate it and say, "This isn't enough to meet my needs. I reject that." It's perfectly within her rights to do so. As long as she has the right to say no, As long as it's her choice, you can give whatever advice you want. And so I would argue on that basis that if it's an even playing field, if everybody has the ability to access representation, pro bono, whatever it's going to be, but if everybody can access representation, then there's nothing wrong with me saying I can do what I like, because they had the option to do differently. They had the option to get advice. Yeah. No, it never goes to court. This case does not seem to go to court.
So what's wrong?
Because the way we understand Asinu Atzmeinu Karcha Dayanim, if you go back to number 14, is that even advice given outside of a court setting is considered a violation. In general, giving one party advice for how they can overpower another, it's not my fight, it's not my issue, is considered inappropriate. That's why. He doesn't, even that's inappropriate. So again, to summarize, and then we're just going to go through the cases one after the other, and the cases go very quickly, so don't worry. I know that our cap is the 90 minutes for the hour and a half for the program. But everybody agrees, between the Jewish system and the general system, there is a need for access to justice. It devolves on the community, it devolves on the officers of the court. There is a need for officers of the court to limit aid for the self-represented party in order to preserve actual and perceived fairness for the represented party. There is a need for the lawyer for the represented party to limit his aid for the self-represented party, thank you. There's a need for the lawyer for the represented party to limit the aid given to the self-represented one, because you have an obligation to the represented party. Judaism may impose certain extra responsibilities. All members of society may have an obligation of chesed, of helping people, but on the other hand, the opposing counsel has a stronger duty within Judaism to herself and to the party who is employing her, which may offset that element of chesed, that element of kindness. And where the self-represented party had the opportunity to pursue counsel and made a rational choice not to, in Judaism, that may actually terminate the responsibility of others to provide help. You still can't cheat them, you can't deceive them, but you don't have to help them, yeah.
Clarification, because you keep mentioning Ketubah, but you're not saying the major point of this. The ketubah only applies if the man leaves. The woman leaves, there's no ketubah. The ketubah has no basis in Jewish law.
If the woman leaves, that's true.
See, I know.
What is that? How does that affect the case?
No, I'm just saying, so you have to, I think you should explain to people who don't know, that it's okay. Only ketubah if the person is leaving her. It never would apply. So if she made an agreement, let's say they made an agreement, something took...
It's an interesting point, but I'm down to my last 20 minutes, so I'm going to stick with this. Okay, cases 1 and 2. The self-represented litigant. So again, go back to the cases that we had. The first case was, it was source number 8. Jonathan sued and lost. He's representing himself in an appeal. Mary is counsel for the opposition. She sees that Jonathan is having difficulty meeting the filing deadline. He doesn't seem to be aware he can request an extension. What do you say? Is Mary expected to inform Jonathan of the option of filing for an extension? Get a no from Sergio. We get no's. It may be prudent to do so. What do you mean?
Well, if you don't, you're going to stress the bad negativity that comes your way.
Okay, so we have no's, but it may be a wise thing to do. I'm going to come back to that. What about the second? Yeah, Mark?
Depends if it's meritorious.
It's not about meritorious. It's just, you mean if the appeal is meritorious? Mm-hmm. As opposed to a frivolous appeal, or why should I help him just to do something that's going to torture my client? Okay, yeah, Irving.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, that's exactly the question here.
But the courts, at least from my experience with litigation, are always in these suspensions anyway. So I
correct.
Don't think that you're really hurting your client, unless you think the judge in this instance won't give the extension.
Right. That's why in Mark said about frivolous. The test is if it's frivolous, then the court won't grant it, but if it's not frivolous, then that's really my threshold.
Right. if it's a quality appeal, we may look at it differently, right? Frivolous, and the other word that I really like that goes every time with frivolous, vexatious. That's a great word. The frivolous or vexatious. The so let's take a look at the second case. I'm going to address both of them together. The second case was the car accident one, right? Sarah can't work anymore. She files the insurance claim without representation. The insurer requests disclosure of the medical records. The insurance counsel knows that she could limit it to 1 year of medical records. She doesn't necessarily know it. Is David required, is he required to advise her that she can do that limit? What would you say?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
There was a yes?
Yes.
Yes, he should inform her that she has an option of capping it at 1 year?
She negotiated an insurance contract, which, and she should be entitled to all of her rights.
The contracting
right, but he is the lawyer for the insurer.
No, that's the contracting part. If he's tasked with adjudicating the case, he has to adjudicate it fairly.
He's not adjudicating anything. He's a lawyer. He's a lawyer. He's not a judge. He's a lawyer.
If he's counsel for the insurer,
yeah,
then he should ask her whether or not in getting this asking this request for disclosure that she gives the disclosure on advice of counsel, because if he doesn't do that, and she gives an inappropriate form of access to medical records, which compromises her, the court will look at the issue and will say the insurance company took advantage of the poor consumer again, and the insurance company will pay triple damages.
Okay, so, yeah.
Sarah is suing the insurance company.
Correct.
She's not being necessarily taken advantage of. She's already started her own claim against the insurance company. If she chooses to go at it alone, the lawyer for the insurance company doesn't have a duty to her.
Right.
She hasn't sued, though.
So she's filed a claim, and then...
Like an insurance claim?
She filed an insurance claim.
Right now, she's just filed an insurance... Right, I shouldn't... Right, let me be precise in the wording. It's an insurance claim. There's no lawsuit at this stage.
You do exactly what... And Frank,
right, there is no...
Insurance policy, your house burns down, you file your claim.
Right. Right.
She has, she's not...
Right, it's not a lawsuit, that's correct. So, I would say the following. Based on what I've seen, and that's the material here plus, but based on what I've seen, the lawyer's duty on the other side, whether the lawyer for the insurance company in this case or the lawyer for Exela Pharmaceuticals in the previous case, is only under obligation not to harm, not to take advantage of the unrepresented party, but is not obligated to say anything proactive either about the extension possibility or about the cap on this. The statement of principles, hang on, the statement of principles that we saw required nothing of the lawyers at all. It only said that they have to make sure that they inform them of the consequences of being unrepresented, explain how to get a representative, provide appropriate sources of information, be respectful, don't use complex legal language, all of those things. But that's really it. And the same thing is true for the rules of professional conduct, which speak about courtesy, acceding to requests, but not about providing information. About the only possible argument that I think you could make to say that the rules require a lawyer to say this would be under the sharp practice argument, but I don't think so. Take a look at number 39. Regarding the point about deadlines, when a caveat has been filed in one Supreme, this is a case that is considered a sharp practice case. When a caveat has been filed in one Supreme Court registry, but not in others, through inadvertence, for whatever reason, it didn't end up happening. It is sharp practice for a lawyer to apply for letters of administration without notifying the lawyer who filed the caveat of the proposed application. You know you can get around him because he made a mistake and it didn't end up in one of the courts. You're going to file in one of those courts. That's sharp practice for you to take advantage. But I don't think that's the same thing as what we're talking about here. It just doesn't. It doesn't sound the same to me. I don't think so.
feeling conspiracy to defraud by the attorney for the insurance company.
What conspiracy to defraud?
Well, I'm telling this girl what her rights are, and she's paid them money to the contract department, but I'll leave. Go
on. Okay.
That's a good job. First party claim as opposed to a third party claim, right? So this, because it's insurers insured, there are.
Yeah.
Separate from.
So there's a relationship that requires it here?
Some obligation. So if it was an adjuster would go out of the way to provide the third party.
That's interesting. So I'll tell you this. I want to look into this question further, whether this the case in particular here is different because it's the insurer with a first party claim. I took this case from an actual case that I'm blanking now on the name. I wish I could remember, but there was a case of someone whose house burned down, and the insurer only provided them with a few months of rent to be able to rent somewhere else and some living expenses. And so when that was all they were doing, and it went on for a while, ultimately they were sued for the value of the house that they had insured. And they ended up, it was a crazy award. It was $1 million or something. It's punitive damages. Sorry? Thank you. That's the case. Thanks. There you go. So in that case, there was a very large punitive damages award, which was then appealed. So that's what I'm basing. That's what I'm basing myself on. But I need to go back and.
And
yeah. Yeah.
When we talk about judges have the right to look at this, let's say this word that used it, or something after the 1 year. That was very detrimental to her right to pay.
Or before the 1 year.
Okay, and then it comes out in evidence. He's going to make a decision whether he uses evidence that he got, not necessarily illegally, but he got without disclosing that he didn't have to disclose.
Right.
And the judge says that if you didn't tell her that she could limit it to 1 year, but you use this in the court case or in the settlement with your client, right? That's unfair. And that would probably lead to the judge to say that this is appealable because the evidence that we relied upon was received.
Right. Good. So that's where I wanted to go with this. And it's something that a couple of people have suggested here, have said things along those lines. Even though I think that you don't have a duty under the rules of professional conduct, rules of procedure, statement of principles, and so on, there are two reasons why I think you should tell them, at least in the first case, about the extension. And possibly in the second case about the limitation on access to the medical records. Number one, if you are acting as an officer of the court, which the lawyer is, you want to make sure that the self-represented party has a fair trial without compromising your fiduciary duty to your clients along the way. So taking advantage of something that they are ignorant of just because they are unrepresented would be a problem. And this is the point in where did I bring this? In number 40. The Advocate Society's principles of professionalism and civility. Advocates must not attempt to gain a benefit for their clients solely due to the fact that a litigant is self-represented. Counsel should cooperate with the court in ensuring that a self-represented litigant receives a fair hearing. At trial, advocates are entitled to raise proper, legitimate objections, but should not take advantage of technical deficiencies in a self-represented litigant's case which do not prejudice the rights and interests of their client. So from that perspective, there is something that you would do. However, the limitation on that is not to give advice on legal strategies. That far you're not expected to go. So I brought in source number 41 from Solomon V. Abugaduma, I think, but I could be pronouncing it wrong. It is not just the duty of judges to ensure that all parties receive a fair hearing. Lawyers are required to do so as well. Counsel are not required to assist parties opposite on matters of substance, nor do they need to make or even to ensure that the parties opposite understand the strategic choices that might be available to them. You assist on scheduling, similar matters, like the first case. The second case, we were already talking about the substance of their case. I'm not so sure that you would have that. But that's one reason in general to help, is in order to make sure that they have their opportunity at the fair trial. That's one reason. I'm actually going to cut questions right now just because I want to make sure to get through this to the end, and then afterwards I'll take comments. But I want to make sure that I wrap up the cases that we're talking about. The second reason, at this time that Jeffrey had sent me in his materials, is that you are helping your client by taking the long view and aiding in procedural matters. In a case like case number one, with the information about the extension, you run the risk that they're going to appeal, and the appeal is going to be accepted, and then the litigation is going to drag on, number one. And then number two, the judge, who has enough of a hassle dealing with self-represented litigants, the judge is going to appreciate your sensitivity, potentially, and be more favorably disposed to you and your client. Thank you for not trying to jump on this self-represented party about his deadline issue, and instead for facilitating the trial and making my job easier. So I don't think that constitutes a bribe. I think it just shows that you're cooperative, and the judge will appreciate that. So that's in cases one and two. Number one, even if you're not obligated to, probably a good idea to do so. Number two, less of an expectation that you would do so. In the Jewish system, if the self-represented party could have retained counsel, then it's fair. Everything that happens is fair. They had the option of retaining counsel. It's nice to help other people out, but it's not the duty of someone who's been hired by the other party. So just don't deceive them actively and you're okay. If, on the other hand, the self-represented party could not have retained counsel, then you have a problem of asymmetrical legal representation. And that's something that we don't like. And in Jewish law, that's one of the chief obstacles to having a lawyer or a tohen in a beit din, in a rabbinical court, is the concern for that asymmetry. However, once it's accepted that one side can have a lawyer and one side not, then just make sure that you're not going to deceive them. The asymmetry is what I pointed out in source number 42. Case number three. So case number three was the case of the underrepresented litigant, where I feel like the lawyer on the other side is not doing a good job. They could demand a lot more. They could make a case for a lot more, and they didn't do so. So what's the story there? So from a secular perspective, if there's real incompetence, you as the lawyer, who knows what she's doing, may need to report directly to Law Pro. Now that requires ascertaining that fault lies with the lawyer and not with the client. Right? You have to know a lot in order to really make sure that that's what's going on. And you can't think of a case where that would happen? Yes. Because you see incompetence going on, and it may even be better for you to do so. Because if you handle it now, just like we said before, if you handle it now, then they can have something taken care of. Otherwise, it's going to come up on appeal. Shall we? That could be. Right, so that's tricky. No, Zevi raises a very important point. You can't say to the opposing party, your lawyer is incompetent. There are rules about that. Please do not try that at home or in court. But the question is, do you have any sort of responsibility to report it in order to help your client so that this case doesn't end up getting appealed?
Surely you have an obligation to go back to your client and say, you know, this guy on the other side is so incompetent that we could end up with a very favorable outcome.
I have 2 minutes to go, so I really want to make sure to get through this. From a Jewish perspective in this case, we'll see this as a case of asymmetrical representation, just like where one side has no lawyer at all. And we would prefer not to have such a case at all. It will then fall to the judge in a case like this, not to the lawyer, but it will fall to the judge to ask the right questions, to make sure that rights that the litigant has are not forgiven inappropriately. It will fall to the judge to make that kind of assessment. It's one of the sources that I skipped. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein was back in source number 25. I'm not going to go into it now, but he makes the point, based on source number 24, that it's up to the judge to figure out if a litigant does not make a claim, and the litigant could have, the question is the litigant simply forgiving the claim, or is the litigant actually... Or is the litigant simply unaware, or the lawyer was unaware and incompetent? It's up to the judge to figure that out, not opposing counsel. It's the judge who's handling the case. Last point, the concerns involved in advising a self-represented party. So we said that you're supposed to help, but we also noted Rule 7.2-9 that you have to make sure that the self-represented party is not proceeding under misimpression. So therefore, you want to, again, make sure that they know what their options are to get representation. Also, make sure you do things in writing. Make sure that there are witnesses so that it's clear what you were saying and what you were not saying, what you were trying to do, what you were not trying to do, and that you warned them that you are not, in fact, their counsel. Jewish perspective is going to be the same. It's the same as the secular perspective in that regard, but with real concern for deception by omission. I brought you the last source, number 43, which talks about a case in which I'm selling somebody a cow. And I know my cow has a problem. I know my cow has a habit of kicking. So I am responsible to inform the buyer of this. I have to say to the buyer, my cow kicks. What if I don't? What if I say, my cow gores, bites, kicks, and sprawls? It's actually, if it gores, it's probably not a cow, it's probably a bull. But my cow does, and I list four different problems, of which only one exists. That's deceptive. Because what's going to happen is, the buyer is going to test for one of them. A 75% odds that he's going to test for it and not find anything. And he's going to say, it's some kind of a legal disclaimer. It's like when it says that there are milk and nuts and soy and eggs in the factory. And he's going to think, don't worry about it, and that's going to be it. That's deceptive, right? If I sell someone a car, and the car has a tendency to veer to the right. So I say to him, you should know about this car. It veers to the right, and this doesn't work, and that doesn't work, and the other thing doesn't work, and he tests for the other things. He never thinks to test for this one. That's deception on my part, and it's inappropriate. So you have to be very careful when you speak to the self-represented party to make sure that to make sure that you are clear about what it is that you're doing and what it is that you're not doing. There was more to say, but I think this covers it for now. I know there were a couple of people who wanted to make comments. I will stick around afterwards. The next session, this is now March, so the next session, I believe, is May 6th. It was originally publicized as May 13th, but it was a mistake. It's being moved Sunday morning, May 6th, at the Bayit in Thornhill. And I don't remember the topic offhand, but you will be getting email about it. If you did not sign in, please make sure you sign in. Sign-in sheets are there and there. And hold on for 1 minute, please. Sorry. I made the announcement at the beginning, but Mickey actually came here just to make the announcement. So,